This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. For the next hour, the conversation might seem a bit dicey and even uncomfortable at times, but it's one we all have sooner or later, and that is how to handle death and burial or cremation. Environmentally friendly services, or green burials, have been winning increasing attention over the past couple decades, in part because they tend to be less expensive than traditional funerals, but also there are ecological benefits too. And there are a variety of choices if you want to go green, including the home funeral done without traditional embalming and involving perhaps a degradable burial shroud or a casket made of straw. There are also other creative alternatives like the reef ball, in which cremated remains or cremains are mixed with cement and then placed in the ocean to encourage the growth of coral reefs. We'll try to get to it all this hour and, as always, take some of your calls and comments as well. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can send us an email to radiotimes at whyy.org or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So here in studio to lend some insight is Mark Harris, a former environmental columnist with the Los Angeles Times Syndicate. Mark Harris is author of a book on green burial called Grave Matters. And a few years back, Mark worked with the board of the Fountain Hill Cemetery in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, to open Green Meadow, a natural cemetery in the Lehigh Valley. And good to have you with us, Mark.
Nice to be here, Mary.
Joining us by phone, Suzanne Kelly has written Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices, and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. Suzanne chaired a committee to form the second municipally operated green burial ground in New York State. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thanks so much for having me.
And later this hour, we'll hear from Katrina Spade, founder of the Urban Death Project in Seattle. But first, let's start with a bit of history and go to you first, Mark. Green burials, no embalming, were what families did for much of human history. And in fact, for much of U.S. history, up until, what, about the early 19th century?
Right, until about the Civil War. You know, up to that time, what we now call green burial was just the default burial. Bodies went into the ground unembalmed. There was no metal casket. There was no concrete burial vault. The body dissolved, became part of the soil, pushed up a tree, vegetation, and joined the natural cycle of life. All that began to change around the mid-1800s. You have the appearance of the burial vault, which initially that concrete box that sits at the bottom of the grave, which was designed initially to deter grave robbers who were resurrecting bodies and supplying early medical schools with cadavers, if you can believe that, up until about 1920. Yeah. And then you have embalming. Now, embalming, of course, has been around for a long time. The early Egyptians were embalming their dead. And this country was seen as anathema because it represented a desecration of the human temple that was the body, the human temple of God. So it was limited. But then you have the Civil War, and then you have these battles where the dead were buried on or near the battlefield where they fell. Sometimes they were in graves that were very hastily dug.
Yeah.
Northern families who wanted to return the remains of their loved ones to the graveyards back home would send emissaries. These emissaries could be friends, family members, early undertakers, to resurrect their deceased and then bring them home. They placed those unburied bodies in wood caskets and then put them in rail cars, headed for northern graveyards back home. Now, in those journeys could be, you know, many thousands of miles, since most of the battlefields were raged on ground in the south. And during the summer months, the conditions in those rail cars were sweltering, sometimes sufficient to explode the casket, that became known as exploding casket syndrome.
You really can't
make these words up. So it made for a very unpleasant arrival back for the home port, and it made viewing the remains difficult. So it was at that point the battlefield surgeons recommended embalming as a way of preserving the remains for that long rail ride home.
And eventually,
it worked as advertised.
Yeah, and it worked and also obviously overcame the concerns of various faith-based organizations and is part of the traditional funeral service. So, but fast forward to today, and Suzanne, there are issues ecologically with or environmentally with embalming and embalming fluid. What are they?
Well, the main problem with embalming fluid is that it's made out of the well-known carcinogen formaldehyde. And while it actually is biodegradable, it poses a threat to worker health. So it actually poses more of a threat to the worker, right, to the embalmer, him or herself, than it does to the land, because okay. eventually it does break down. So embalming fluid is one thing, but then there's, you know, what came after that, that Mark was talking about, the creation of the modern casket that's made out of sealed, you know, and treated hardwoods and all kinds of metals. And then, of course, the burial vault, which, as he said, is most often made out of reinforced concrete. It's sometimes also made out of steel. Sometimes it's made out of plastic. Sometimes it's even made out of asphalt, which we know is a semi-solid form of petroleum, all of which, you know, in great numbers goes into the ground every year.
Yeah, and all of which takes up a lot of space, and many municipalities right. are having a difficulty with this. I think, what, New York City has completely run out of space for cemeteries?
Pretty much, yeah.
So we're going to get back to different ways of addressing that issue, but let's bring in the, the resurgence of the home funeral, which, again, was, you know, a few generations back, you know, you had your loved one laid right. out in the parlor for a few right. days. And we're seeing more of that. Suzanne, describe how today's home funeral usually works and why this is becoming increasingly a choice.
Well, it really depends. I mean, in 9 states in the U.S., you still need the help of a licensed funeral director to deal with some aspect of the funeral. New York State happens to be one of those states. So I'm most familiar with that because I live in New York. And so while you still can have a home funeral, which means that you can have the viewing of the body inside your living room, inside your home parlor, in the way that we did it largely. I mean, I still know families, that had this up until the 1960s. So it's not all that long ago that it sort of fell away. In New York State, you still need to have the presence of a licensed funeral director to transport the body to the home, if it needs to be transported back to the home, then to also to file the burial permit, and also, ultimately, if the body is going to be buried, to oversee the burial of the body. But there is, as you said, a rising tide of folks who are trying to not just bring the funeral back to the home, but to advocate for families' rights to care for their own dead, by supporting and educating people on what many home funeral advocates call sort of lost knowledges of how we once cared for our dead before the funeral industry sort of took it over.
Well, what is the importance of rituals which connect us to death, and how does a home funeral perhaps help us know more about those rituals and bring us even closer to our loved one?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the things that we saw, you know, in 1963, Jessica Mitford published her book, The American Way of Death, right, which is a really well-known, popular book, and it did a lot to sort of bring attention to these rituals that people didn't really identify with, that they thought were sort of created by the funeral industry and that were, you know, sort of over the top and expensive and that people didn't really identify with. And so it sort of touched a nerve with the American public, which was great, and it also created a lot of good reform. We had the Funeral Consumers Alliance sort of grow out of that and sort of pay attention to what was going on with the funeral industry. But while all of that good work happened, we sort of, at the same time, started to move away from rituals around the body, as we see sort of a distancing from those rituals that are tied to the funeral industry. We also see a rise in direct cremation, right? So where families have no connection to the body at all, the body goes, you know, en route sometimes from the morgue, you know, straight to the crematory, and then there may be rituals around the dispersing of ashes, but not around the body itself. So the move toward back to the funeral in the home, or just more specifically around families' right to care for their dead, to be more intimate with the care for their dead, is really about bringing those practices, those rituals, back into sort of the living inner circle.
There was and still is a fear that dead bodies are carriers of contamination. Mark, could you address that?
No, that's not true. I mean, I think they've even found that during periods when we've gathered remains during national disasters, you know, hurricane, particularly during Hurricane Katrina. So a dead body is inert. It's not expelling. It's not breathing. It's not emitting any noxious fumes. I mean, evidence shows that a dead body is not a contagion. And particularly if you're not opening the body as you do in the embalmer's room, where you're letting the blood out and you're flushing that blood and whatever pathogens potentially into the sewer, the body in a home funeral or certainly in a green burial, the whole idea is to let it return, decay naturally, and go back to the earth.
Suzanne Kelly, many of, if not most of us, are uncomfortable talking about death. And I can just imagine what some of our listeners are thinking right now as we dive into this conversation.
Yeah.
How do you get past the ick factor?
The ick factor?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is very much there, and I think it's very much tied to what Mark was just talking about, that there is this sort of overwhelming, prevailing belief that the dead body is a contaminant. But at the same time, people are really curious. You know, people are really curious about this death in general in terms of, like, you know, bringing it out into the public, out into the conversation, but also specifically, I would say, around the practices, the way that the dead is cared for, because it's been so sort of removed from our lived experience. So while people, I think there's two things going on at the same time. One is kind of an ick factor, a sort of, you know, oh, I don't want to look at it. And then there's sort of this curiosity. And I think that what we see with green burial, the rise of green burial practices and the movement is what, you know, the founder of the Green Burial Council, Joe Sahe, called sort of a sparkle in people's eyes, right? They, sort of a twinkle in their eyes when they start talking about, when they start having these conversations, because the reclamation of these lost knowledges becomes sort of very empowering for people.
Yeah. Women were once the people who prepared the body for burial after death, and you point out that women also worked as midwives, bringing new life into this world. Both roles eventually became professionalized. How do you read
yes.
this, Suzanne?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think, again, this goes back to knowledge, right? The reclaiming of knowledges. You know, feminists have long said that, you know, we're especially when it came to childbirth, that taking back those practices, taking back the reins of those practices when it came to natural childbirth was not just about the practices themselves, but about the knowledges that had essentially been robbed from the bodies of women, from the experiences of women. And I think the same can be said here, that we once cared for our dead. It was primarily the women of the family or women who were designated within communities to do this kind of work. But those knowledges have kind of been, you know, forced aside and pushed underneath the surface, making it seem like really we don't know how to care for our own dead. So I think, you know, this is not just a struggle for a reclaiming of practices. Again, it really is about a struggle for knowledge.
Mark?
Well, and we see the rise of the funeral industry, which started with the early undertakers. I mean, really, by the time of the 1900s, we've got death moving out of the house. We've got the funeral director, who starts off as the undertaker. He's the one who's doing the embalming, but only he has the patented embalming chemicals. Only he knows how to embalm. And then suddenly he starts procuring the casket from the local carpenter. He's the one working, making arrangements with the livery boy to transport the casket from the funeral home or from the church to the grave. And the next thing you know, he's undertaking just about everything when it comes to terms mm-hmm. of death care. He becomes a full-blown funeral director, and he operates out of his own funeral parlor, which is a replica of the real thing.
And we're going to talk some more about that in just a moment. We're up against a break. And also, this note, too, that many in the funeral industry are now moving toward and embracing greener burial practices. But I want to get back to the concept of, you know, how that affects us. Death moves out of the house. What does that mean to us? Mark Harris is here with us. He is author of Grave Matters. Suzanne Kelly has written Greening Death. And if you'd like to call us, 888-477-9499. Radio Times continues in just a moment. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Green burials are becoming increasingly popular in the United States, and we're talking about what this involves. Suzanne Kelly is author of Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. And Mark Harris is a former environmental columnist with the Los Angeles Times Syndicate and the author of the book on green burial called Grave Matters. And going into the break, we were talking about the move from home funeral toward the more traditional services over the past century and a half or so. And when this happened, death moved out of the house. Right. So when death moved out of the house, how did that affect us as families and as a society, Mark Harris?
Well, I mean, I think that we began to see that we had no or very little role to play when it came to death, that we consigned our dead to a stranger who conducted his affairs in this strange place that we had to go and visit with our deceased at fixed times, according to the funeral director's schedule. And I think that we become passive mourners. We're no longer engaged in that more intimate connection with our deceased, as Suzanne had been talking about. And I think that we began to number one, forget that we still have the same rights our forebears had. We still can take care of our death. We can still have a very personalized funeral. We, in the vast majority of states, we can act as our own funeral director. We don't need a funeral director at all. We can still go get that casket. We can make it ourselves. We can, we can still purchase it over the internet. If we're using a funeral director, he can't charge us a handling fee to do so. He has to accept that third-party casket. So I think there was the loss of the knowledge. There was a lack of the loss of that knowledge meant that we became bad consumers because we show up, we don't plan these very often. And then I think that we lose with that more intimate engagement with the deceased, that body itself, which I think plays a huge role in the healing process when a death occurs.
Well, let's talk some more about that. Just a few more moments on the home funeral. Suzanne, I've read, in the research I was doing that, it can be a real comfort to be hands-on with a loved one who's passed away. I mean, bluntly, if you're not going to have the funeral director take the body, you take care of it at home. And again, this is where women perhaps used to come in to help the family do this. There is preparation that has to happen. Without getting too terribly much into detail, Suzanne, could you kind of give us a look at that, acknowledging that this is not for everyone, this route? Suzanne?
I haven't been trained in home funeral care, so yeah. I will do my best based on my own research. By the way, the home funeral movement has been guided in large part by the National Home Funeral Alliance that has a whole bunch of information if people are interested, even trainings and that sort of thing. But, the body needs to be cared for in really basic ways. It needs to be cleansed. Sometimes it's anointed with oils. It needs to be dressed. It needs to be placed in the burial container. And it needs to remain cold. It's really important. So, embalming fluid was sold on the promise of preservation, on sanitation and on preservation, and it temporarily preserves the body, really well. We know that.
Yeah.
But you can also temporarily preserve the body for viewing by refrigeration before the body comes out for viewing. That's one way to do it. You can also use something called TechniCe that is placed around and near the largest organs of the body. So these things are being used right now by advocates of the home funeral movement and specifically by families.
Yeah. And again, it just can make people feel perhaps closer to the deceased, perhaps in a way that might not be present with a traditional funeral, and not knocking that either because, the home funeral is not for everybody.
Everyone, right.
So, okay, let's get to some telephone calls. Terry is in Doylestown, and welcome to Radio Times, Terry.
Good morning, friends. Thanks so much, Susanna. You're doing such a wonderful job advocating for the home funeral. Thank you. And I would like to mention again the HomeFuneralAlliance.org. We've developed a bunch of materials about how to handle the, how to care for the dead body, making informed decisions, even home funerals 101. And we've got about 1,200 members who help people do this across the country. I also really appreciate your observation that, any ice block that you would use to pack a brown bag lunch can be used for a body, Cooling is all you need, your air conditioner or, ice blocks from your picnic basket.
So we've got a couple more seconds. I'm sorry, a couple more seconds, Terry.
Thank you.
So it sounds like this movement is growing. How many people did you say belong to your organization?
1,200, I think she said.
Yes. And there's an organization, a similar organization in Canada, and there's a very big death midwife, death doula movement in the United States and in England as well. And that's a group of people who are related to the home funeral crowd. They kind of deal with folks as they are approaching death, and many of them are also trained as home funeral guides. And one thing I would like to make the point of, that the home funeral folks aren't aiming to establish themselves as new experts in the industry. Like, we're not trying to just become another layer of funeral care professionals so you don't have to worry your pretty little head about it. The idea is that we actually just give people the lost knowledge that Suzanne mentioned so that everybody has the capacity to do it if they want.
Terry, thank you so much for the call to Radio's Times.
Thanks.
So again, fascinating. Death midwives. You have this, this growing occupation, whether it's professional or not. And again, a couple centuries ago, this is probably a friend, a female, an aunt, a cousin, a woman in the village who would come up to essentially perform the same service.
Right. And so you have people like Terry, who is from Doylestown and is a home funeral midwife, as they call them. You know, she leads workshops where she'll help you learn how to do what our forebears used to do as a matter of course. I guess the other thing I'd say about home funerals is I also teach courses on green burial, and students say, oh, you know, it's something I don't want to do. I think it's important to keep in mind that you don't have to do everything. You don't have to have the entire, you know, funeral in your home. You don't have to do all the washing, the dressing, the filing of the paperwork. You can bring in a funeral director to help with various aspects of it. So, but perhaps you don't want to transport the remains. Perhaps you don't want to file the paperwork, but maybe you do want to have your loved one laid out in her own bedroom and, you know, in her own clothing, and you want to have the neighborhood and friends come by and visit with the deceased in that comfortable setting. You can do that. It doesn't have to be, you don't have to do the whole thing.
Sounds like a smart idea to have somebody there, though, whether it is a funeral director or somebody in Terry's organization, because there is a lot to it. There is the death certificate. There is the matter of transport, which is, I think, different from state to state, or can be different from state, aside from the actual the actual ceremony.
Yeah, it's not a do it yourself and let's figure it out at the last minute. You really do need to have some training. Even just moving a body is not something you'd be able to handle by yourself.
Right. Suzanne, wisdom in thinking about this ahead of time. Most, if not many of us prefer not to think about death and funerals and how we might like to be packaged as we head out. As I said, there's a lot to it. It's usually left to your descendants to handle if you don't tackle it early.
It's true. I would say, you know, that the green burial movement and the home funeral movement, as it's part of this, you know, sort of tide of alternative death movement that's happening across the U.S., is about bringing these questions and these conversations out into our living rooms, basically out into our kitchen tables, and having these conversations, which all sort of started, I think, in large part with, you know, focus on palliative care and hospice and end-of-life matters, and now is moving to after-death care. Even if we look at the work of, you know, say, like, an elder care lawyer or something like that, right, where they're getting you to do advanced care directives and that sort of thing, you know, having these kinds of conversations lead into ultimately talking about how you want your body cared for after your death so that your family members know. And I think it's particularly important when it comes to whether or not you want to have a home funeral, whether or not you want to have a green burial, because if your family doesn't know that that's what you want, once a person dies, sort of the funeral industry machine takes over, and it's very hard to get possibly get what you want at that time.
Tell us about the rise of the Death Cafe, which is kind of a grisly name, but really the purpose is anything, anything but. Mark?
These death cafes, which are, you know, sprung up around the country and around the world, actually, it's an international phenomenon. It's an opportunity for people to get together in their communities and have a conversation about the great taboo topic of death and dying.
It's relaxed.
It's very relaxed. They're usually held in, central locations and public locations. So it could be a coffee house. The one I went to that was led by Terry, in fact, was in a bookstore. There's no agenda. There's no speaker. It's just an opportunity to talk about whatever comes to mind. It could be talking about the death of a loved one. Maybe you're doing some funeral planning. Maybe you're just expressing grief from a recent passing. It's just refreshing. And I think that once you have these conversations, then you can start feeling perhaps a little bit better about your own demise and then start thinking about the fact that somebody is going to have to plan for your burial.
Suzanne, I want to get to cremation just for a moment. Is it a greener choice than traditional burial?
Yeah, it's definitely greener. And I think by and large, you know, folks who, you know, are thinking about green burial or advocates for green burial think about it as a sort of the second most environmentally sound way of disposing of the dead. You know, if it's less than ideal, it's only because anytime you burn something, you know, you pose a threat to soil, water, and air. And so, in Europe, they actually place better filters on their crematories than we do in the U.S. So, having sort of better regulation, better filters on our crematories, finding more fuel-efficient ways to run our crematories, I think, you know, sort of that's part of the movement, too. For many people, you know, whole-body earth burial is still not for them, and they like the idea of burning. So, moving toward these more environmentally sound ways of burning the dead is also part of this vision.
And let's get to some creative ways. We've got an email from Stone who says, I've been interested in the Native American practice of sky burial. Any info on this and legality, etc.? Mark, are you familiar with
this? Yes, I know people are very interested in sky burial, and it tends to be something people are more interested in than actually pursue. There was an organization in Texas which built one of these towers of silence in which, the body was going to be laid out on a pier and remains would be pecked to death by birds of carrion, which is practiced in parts of, the Far East. But it's not widely practiced. In fact, that didn't even get off the ground, so to speak, given lots of legal challenges to it. So unless Suzanne knows of a place where sky burials are actually happening, it's a great idea. Perhaps it's a time will eventually come.
Well, other rather creative alternatives, as I think I mentioned in the open, clients can turn cremains into reef balls, which are placed on the ocean floor. I think that's out near Atlanta. And there's also a mushroom burial suit. But can you describe this for us, Suzanne? Are you familiar with this? It's a hand-sewn shroud of mushroom spores.
Yes, I've seen the mushroom burial suit. Though, unless I'm wrong about this, I believe it's still in the prototype stage.
Okay.
So I don't know if it's available yet for use. But I think it's actually a suit that has mushrooms on it that are supposed to not only help with the decay of the body, I guess the premise is that the body needs help decaying, but also to cleanse the body. And this, I think it's predicated on this idea, the body has toxins in it, according to what they're selling, and that the body needs to be cleansed of its toxins. But I wouldn't necessarily say that everyone's in agreement that the dead body is full of toxins that needs to be cleansed. Mm. But I think that that's how it's being sold.
So some of these alternatives might be still kind of fringe choices.
And I think still in the works.
So what are the parameters for the traditional green burial mark?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think the whole thing is in flux. If you want to talk about the greenest of burials, it's the burial of an unembalmed body in a vaultless grave situated in some natural setting.
And we're seeing more of this in the United States. Well, legally set up cemeteries which allow
this. Well, that's right. So we're seeing more of these natural cemeteries where they allow that kind of burial. So some of them are freestanding. So there might be a place like Ramsey Creek in South Carolina where the dead are buried in the woods. Again, sometimes not even with a casket. Casket's not required. No burial vault, obviously. Body goes into the ground unembalmed. But then there are also the rise of these natural cemeteries like Ramsey Creek. So when I first started my research back in the early 2000s, Ramsey Creek was one of a handful, maybe three or four, that were such such green cemeteries. Now there are about 150, really, maybe even closer to 200 in the United States. And there's one in the Lehigh Valley. There's one in the Philadelphia area. Mm. And again, these are places within existing cemeteries for the most part where they've carved off a section. It's green. They allow for this kind of burial. They're native plantings, and it looks obviously a lot different than, the other side of the cemetery with its landscape of headstones.
Yeah, because I was wondering about environmental concerns, an aquifer that might be going nearby. I mean, is that something that needs...
Well, sure. I mean, any cemetery, green or not, needs to be sited with concerns about groundwater and such. So the advantage of these regular cemeteries is that they've already been sited for that. Mm-hmm. So they're very they don't pose an environmental hazard. Suzanne, do you have something to add about that?
Yeah, no, I agree. That is a really big advantage. It's already been done.
Yeah. All right, let's get to some more comments. Helena has kind of a different view of the home funeral. She sent us an email and says, my grandfather was laid out at home. She says it was exhausting to have people coming 10 hours a day and having to greet them and go over the details of his illness and death many times. We did have a funeral director, but it was still wearing on family members. And Suzanne, I think as we mentioned earlier, a home funeral is for some, but not for all.
Yeah, I think that's true, and I think Mark made this point as well, that, they're this advocating for families' rights to care for their dead that the home funeral movement is about isn't necessarily always about bringing the dead back into the home. For some people, that might not work. I mean, you may have a really tiny home, for instance, or an apartment on a six-floor walk-up, or, it may just not be practical for some people, and it also just not be maybe comfortable for some people. So, picking and choosing among these things, I think, is sort of what the home funeral movement is about, and giving families the right to care for their dead if they want to, in the way that they want to.
All right, we're going to try to squeeze in a phone call before the break. Zeldine is live with us from Philadelphia. Hello, Zeldine.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am going to be buried at West Laurel Hill. They have a section of the cemetery that's devoted entirely to that, which is a wooded area that's going to grow towards, fill in the burial. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be buried in a white shroud directly into the ground. I found this out through my sister, who was up in Ithaca. They have quite a setup up there. I went to take a look at it and felt that it was important for me personally to go into the ground the way I wanted to. And no vault, no nothing, just a white shroud. I also have a funeral director at West Laurel Hill. I carry a card with me. God forbid I should die in the middle. They come and get me. My children are aware of this, and I have a son whose ashes are here in my house, and we've also made arrangements for those ashes to be placed in the same spaces my body's going to be in. Mm-hmm. And then there'll be a plaque. There's going to be a stone wall around this area, and they're going to put plaques on the wall with the name of the deceased, so there won't be people trampling over cemetery property. And the wooded area will grow into this area. In the meantime, they have plantings up there, seasonal plantings, and one year they had black-eyed Susans. It was just a beautiful area.
It sounds pretty. Yeah. I'm going to have to stop you there, Zeldine. Thank you for calling us here at Radio Times. This, we're hearing more of this, and especially among boomers, correct? There's more of an interest among people of a certain age in this country.
Well, I mean, that's
our earthy, crunchy boomer generation.
Well, I mean, I think they're at the leading edge, and many of the early advocates of green burial have been baby boomers. But I think that when people realize what green burial is about, it's not just about environmental concerns, but it's about, returning the dead to a natural environment. It's about taking control of the funeral. It's about saving money. It's about being more participatory. It's I think when people realize that it speaks to those old-fashioned American values of thrift and simplicity, then people say, hey, this is something that I've been wanting to do for a long time.
All right. Mark Harris is the author of Grave Matters, Suzanne Kelly of Greening Death, and we're going to be joined by Katrina Spade in just a moment here on Radio Times on WHYY. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've been taking a look at the increasing interest in environmentally friendly funerals and burials and innovation, which gets us pretty far away from the traditional embalming and casket. Our guests this hour include Mark Harris, author of the book Grave Matters. Suzanne Kelly has written Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. And we're also going to touch base now with Katrina Spade, founder and director of the Urban Death Project in Seattle. Welcome to Radio Times, Katrina.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about your project for a few moments. Much of the purpose of green burial seems to be to get the body back to the earth in as natural a form as possible. Your project seeks to expedite the process and then make active use of the remains, if I've got this right. Could you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that sounds about right. I was inspired back in graduate school for architecture by green burials. I think they're a totally beautiful concept. And I was also sort of lucky enough to stumble upon work by agricultural researchers and farmers who'd been composting cows and other livestock for decades. I sort of put those two things together and invented a system that would compost us, compost humans, and that was particularly meant for the urban settings where natural burial is harder to put together.
And where there's less space for cemeteries in the first place. So what would this structure look like? What would the building look like that does this?
Well, the general idea is that the composting or recomposition, which is how we've renamed it, takes place in a core structure that's about 3 stories tall. And it's vertically designed because in our cities, we don't have a lot of space, so we want to make the footprint as small as possible. And so if you could imagine a building where you would come up with your friends and family to celebrate the life of someone you've lost, and their body would be recomposed inside this 3-story core.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, one of the things that's so exciting about this, to me anyway, is that that core, that sort of technical system, becomes part of this new ritual. And so the friends and family, the living, carry the dead up around ramps that wrap around these three-story core, lay the body into the core at the top, into a mixture of wood chips and other material like sawdust that's high in carbon.
Mm-hmm.
And that begins the composting process that lasts for approximately 4 to 6 weeks.
And you're working with Washington State University on this?
Yeah, our next big step is to build a prototype of this system that I just described to you at Washington State University, and we'll run a pilot program there in collaboration with their soil science department.
And how, Katrina, how do you envision this eventual mulch being used?
I mean, you know, I think it could be used so many ways. I envision there being gardens on site at every one of these locations, because then you come to this place and you see the plant life growing from the bodies of the deceased. I think that's a beautiful reminder that we're part of nature. And then also people, friends and family, could take some of the finished material home and grow their roses, a grove of trees, bring it out to that conservation land that they love so much. There's a lot of ways it could be used.
So do you think it's going to be a challenge perhaps to convince political leaders and community members that this is workable and not macabre?
I mean, personally, I don't think so. And I've heard from thousands of people who are interested in this option. The same types of folks who say, you know what, I don't want my body pumped full of formaldehyde. I don't want it in a concrete box, in a casket forever. Those people are more and more turning to cremation. There's this tremendous rise in that trend. But I think in a lot of ways, cremation has become a default that's kind of just like better than. It's not super exciting for people. They just pick it as a default. And so for people who can't access natural burial, this option may be just right for them.
And do you think this is actually going to come? Do you see that this is going to be in place in say, a few years and ready to go?
Oh, yeah, my entire life's work now is dedicated to making this available. And that's the thing. How can we make it available to as many people as possible in the shortest amount of time?
So, Katrina Spade, when you tell people of this, what is the reaction you generally get?
Well, it makes really great dinner table talk. So,
I bet it does.
At any dinner party, all I have to do is say what I do for a living. You know, I think most of the time you get this kind of like, oh, doesn't that exist already? A reaction.
Really?
I think it's a good one. It means people think it should, and maybe already does exist. And then for those who feel a little squeamish about the idea, you know, it doesn't take much. You don't have to get into much of the details of conventional burial before people feel squeamish anyway.
Sure.
Like, I think that is something we don't talk about very much. One of the missions of our nonprofit organization is to get people talking about death more openly, and it's a great kind of byproduct of this work.
Well, you're quoted, Katrina, as saying, decay and composition are amazing processes we are terrified of. And, of course, we just referred to squeamishness a moment ago. How do you change the worldview?
My main strategy is to talk really matter-of-factly about these processes. And then, you know, what I kind of forgot or re-remembered when I was back in grad school was that all of human life depends on this process. It's not just that they're really cool. The creation of soil is really cool. It's like, if we didn't have decay and decomposition, we wouldn't exist at all. So just to remember that we're part of this incredible cycle, those processes that make us squeamish are also the basis for all of human life. So I think it goes even beyond being really amazing to just being practically spiritual in my mind.
And Suzanne Kelly, your reaction to Katrina's worldview?
I think that Katrina's work is really interesting and innovative, and I think that the celebrating of the value of decay is a really, really important part of what's happening with the green burial movement, and you know, and with her work as I see it included in this move to green death. And I think the other thing that's really important about what Katrina's doing is that she's really addressing a problem that we didn't have 150 years ago, when, you know, these sort of dust to dust practices were the norm, which is that 80% of the population lived in rural areas then, and 20% of the population lived in urban areas, and today it's the reverse. And so with the majority of people living in urban areas, you know, green burial in terms of these bucolic oases that are really far away from cities in most cases may not be speaking to everyone's needs or wants. You know, there's been some really interesting developments of burial grounds that have developed on the outskirts of cities, like Prairie Creek and Penn Forest outside of Pittsburgh. But for the most part, many of them are far away from large cities where the majority of people live. So I think that Katrina's work is really interesting because of that.
All right, Katrina Spade, so good to have you along with us. Thanks so much for sharing.
Thanks for having me.
Right, take care. Katrina Spade is founder and director of the Urban Death Project in Seattle. Let's get back to the phones. Brian in Ewing, New Jersey, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to call in and say that I was living in Philadelphia about 9 years ago. My partner passed away, and before the nurse came to do the death certificate, I and a friend really cleansed off the body in a very loving way, and I lit candles in the room and said some prayers during that, and it wasn't like, oh, there's a dead body, get it out of here. It was a very spiritual and, I guess, rich experience, and that really actually helped me as I moved into my grieving process to very tenderly take care of the body instead of it being like in a hospital and they just kind of, you know, took it away or whatever. And yeah. I'll also note that when I was during that process, eventually the funeral home, the people from the cremation place came and picked up the body, and they were like, well, we're putting it in a bag. We don't want you to watch us zipping up the bag. I'm like, no, I want to watch. I want to be there for every moment of this, and because it was part of the journey. And so I also used to be a grief counselor at a hospice, so I was kind of more open to experiencing these things. But so anyway, it was just part of the whole experience of being with that person, and the relationship with them did not end when their body passed away.
Brian, thanks so much for sharing your story with us on Radio Times. Okay. And Mark Harris, I see you nodding your head while he was talking.
Well, you hear that a lot from people who have engaged more intimately with their deceased, that they, I wouldn't say uniformly, but often say it aids in the healing process. So instead of being something we should be afraid of, the body ends up becoming a way for us to celebrate the deceased and to nurture as we did with them in life and move on with our grief.
Yeah. And again, you know, it's hopefully if we all think about preparing ahead and thinking about what we might want and in discussing this sort of thing with relatives and loved ones. Suzanne, I'm guessing you could probably ask the funeral director who you might want to work with if you can have latitude and say, I want to take care of the body. I want to be there for this, that, and the other process. Are we seeing more leeway here with more traditional funeral practices?
I think it depends, you know, the funeral director that you're dealing with, you know, and so I think it's important. That's another reason why it's important, I think, to plan ahead, to go ahead and meet with a funeral director and see, you know, what they're willing to offer you, how they're willing to work with you, and find a funeral director that you're comfortable with. If you're in a state where you need to use a funeral director, and even in a state where you don't, if you want to use a funeral director, you know, in my hometown, the funeral directors have been really accommodating in terms of what people want, and so we are seeing a bit of a shift.
All right, let's get to some comments. I'm just going to read a few of them here. An email from Rise, who says the Steelmantown Cemetery in Steelmantown, New Jersey, is the only green cemetery in New Jersey. My nephew was buried there a few years ago, and my husband and I purchased plots there last year. Email from Fred, I signed up with Pennsylvania Humanity Gifts Registry. My body goes for medical research. It does some good for humanity. After a year, the remains are cremated, commingled with others, and group buried. And then we have a tweet from Munsinglaw, I believe. Quakers have been practicing green burials for centuries. So, okay, and let's try to get one more telephone call in here. Jane in Boyertown, Pennsylvania is with us now. Welcome to Radio Times, Jane.
Hi, Mary. I just wanted to say I've been involved in two situations where we've actually taken care of the body. We didn't do the coffin part of it, but the first one was a friend of mine who his sister and myself and his ex-girlfriend were all kind of helping to wash the body, and his parents were kind of sitting in the background. And the thing that I found really kind of moving about that was that we actually started telling stories, and there was a lot of laughter. And I think for his parents, it was a really great experience because he was quite young when he died. And for them to kind of like be able to sort of sit there for a period of time and just kind of be with him before, you know, the body was whisked away, it just felt very healing. And the other situation was with my father, and the same thing happened in a way, because it was like for my mother to have that time to kind of be with him while we did that, and then later on his 94-year-old brother came to visit. And in both cases, one of the things that I noticed was that when they both died at home, and you know, we'd been involved in their care, and you see them going through this process of death, and the, you know, it's, there's a lot of kind of trauma around that in a way.
Yeah, sure.
And the body, you know, it's being treated as, well, the person is being treated as a patient, and they often look quite mm-hmm. sick. Mm. And what happened in both cases was after we washed the body, there was a kind of a peacefulness about the body, and we dressed it in sort of like normal street clothes, and, you know, they looked more normal in a way and very mm-hmm. peaceful. And I felt like there was a change that happened that allowed people to perhaps remember them in a different way. And my friend, when he got taken away, they actually embalmed the body, and the body looked really artificial after that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It just felt sort of more natural.
Well, Jane, we're up against the clock, but I want to pick up on a couple of points you made. Thanks so much for the call to Radio Times. I'm sure, Suzanne Kelly, you've heard this sort of sentiment before, but also, you know, it almost doesn't make sense, but there can be laughter and even mm-hmm. joy in
yes.
times during times of great sadness, and especially in situations like this.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's not like we haven't seen this before. I mean, I grew up in a fairly large Catholic family, Irish Catholic family. So, you know, the Irish wake is filled with laughter and alcohol and telling stories. So I don't know that that's totally been lost to us, but it's been lost to many of us. And so bringing this back, and also, as Mark pointed out before, to have the time and space that you need if you want to have it in the home as opposed to the funeral parlor to tell these stories and to have this laughter, that it's not limited to these 2 hours, right, that are often sort of like, you know, blocked off for us to get all of it in, that we may want to extend that time. And as the other caller mentioned, I think something similar to what the last caller mentioned, you know, this aiding in the healing process, but also the spiritual meanings that one of them mentioned, right? So that this is about aiding in the healing process, but also about meaning making. And sometimes without the presence of the body, we sort of are robbed of that opportunity to make these meanings around death that we so sorely need, you know, as human beings.
Mark?
Well, and I think that the funerals that I have been to, the green ones, have been more celebratory of the deceased, more reflective of the values of the deceased. So, yes, you get the tears, you get the crying, but you get a lot of cheering, you get a lot of laughter, there's toasting. So I remember being aboard a ship that was depositing one of these reef balls off the coast of New Jersey. When that reef ball went into the ocean, you know, that was the burial, everyone raised their glasses and they cheered, and there were hugs and there was laughter. There was a sense that you were doing the right thing by the deceased. Here was somebody who had dived off those waters and loved swimming in them, and you were returning them to the place he loved. I mean, how, you know, death is certainly representative of a loss, but here was something that was a celebration of the deceased, but also it was also re-nourishing life under the sea. I mean, this man was quite literally living on and promoting new life. It doesn't get any better than that, I think.
Well, and we've only got about 20 seconds left, so Suzanne will give you the last word. But it sounds like we're coming full circle, because in the early days of cemeteries, you write that, you know, they were not only places of grief, but of celebration. Weddings and partings and picnics were held at cemeteries.
Well, the church graveyards of the early 1800s were not. But when the okay. dead were banned from the church graveyards and pushed out into the outskirts of town, it gave rise to what we know as the rural cemetery movement, which was really a precursor to the parks movement in the U.S. So Mount Auburn in Boston is probably the most well-known one. These beautiful, you know, bucolic oases that we were, you know, celebrating death in the presence of nature.
Got to stop you there, unfortunately. Suzanne Kelly is author of Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Tie to the Earth. Thank you so much. Mark Harris is author of a book on green burial called Grave Matters. Our thanks to you as well, Mark.
Thank you.
And as always, check out our Facebook page and our podcast, whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us.